This podcast is a part of Sphera,
a collective of independent media outlets from across Europe.
For more information,
visit sphera-hub.com.
Hello and welcome to Late Night Europe with me, Katie Lee, and my friend Dominic Kramer in Amsterdam. We never record this late, listeners. It's like bedtime. So I think the show's going to have a very relaxed vibe this week.
Yeah, although I was just cycling home from rehearsal and a pigeon literally flew into my face.
Ooh.
And flapped around.
That'll wake you up.
Yeah, so I'm feeling quite like full of adrenaline.
Well,
how are you?
Very exciting. I'm all right. It is elderflower season at the moment. So I've been doing a bit of my annual foraging to make elderflower cordial, like the woodland gnome that I am. Very wholesome activity, unless you have hay fever, which is terrible this year for some reason. It's very pollen-y out there. It's not safe for people like me. And it got to the stage where I was like stumbling around in the bushes, weeping and like grabbing blindly at foliage, like hoping some of it was elderflower because I couldn't see anything. So it wasn't really the relaxing Saturday that I planned.
That sounds awful, Katie. But also, I feel like this thing about hay fever being terrible this year is something people say every single year.
Yeah, but I did sneeze like 60 times this morning. It's real. I'm not making it up.
That sounds really awful. Weird things have been happening to me too. First, the pigeon flew into my face, but also...
That is weird.
For the first time in my life, or since the pandemic started, I'm behind on RuPaul's Drag Race. I haven't seen the latest episodes from either the Spanish or the Down Under franchise. And
oh, is it in Spanish now?
Yeah, it's really worth watching. It's so interesting how different they all are, all the different franchises. And I've realised the reason why I'm behind, and it's because I've suddenly become obsessed with football, which for anyone who knows me will come as a bit of a surprise, and I don't know what's happening to me.
I was going to say, you feeling all right?
Yeah, but I guess it's because it's like a European championship and I've been doing this podcast for so long that anything that has Europe in it, oh, I should watch that.
Yeah, we often talk about how it's like one of the few cultural moments that we really share as a continent, but I don't care. Still football.
I'm into it. Anyway, if you're not into it, we're not going to be talking about football all episode, we promise. This week, Katie is going to be interviewing two women who have reworked the Brussels metro map with all the 69 stations named after women who have made a mark in Europe through the ages. I think it sounds like a great project and one that highlights the fact that a lot of public space in Europe is dominated by the names of men. Can't wait to hear more about what Mary Fitzgerald and Francesca Cavallo have been getting up to later on in the show. But first...
Who's had a good week?
So, because I'm into football, I'm giving good week to the German football scene for their attempts to support LGBT rights this week.
Yay!
Yeah, it's something that's taken me by surprise a bit. I hadn't thought of football as the most queer-friendly of sports. There's obviously been quite a long and pretty stubborn history of homophobia in football. And I have to say, I was quite cheered to see that things might be improving, if just a little bit. First, there was this action taken by Germany's captain and goalkeeper, Manuel Neuer, who has been wearing a rainbow armband during all of the German Euro 2020 matches and also a few matches leading up to the tournament. It's a very simple gesture, but a gesture of solidarity during this Pride Month that will be seen by millions of people around the world.
There was some pushback against that, though, wasn't there?
Yeah, he was investigated by UEFA. They were looking into whether the armband broke their rules on prohibiting on-pitch political statements. It's a bit like those non-political Eurovision rules, actually.
It's the same. There you go, football and Eurovision.
It's basically the same. That's why I'm into it. And the UEFA rules state that the basic compulsory equipment must not have any political, religious or personal slogans, statements or images. UEFA got a whole lot of criticism for even investigating the armband. It's obviously a very thorny topic whether or not the rainbow flag can be seen as political. I'll come to that later. But fortunately for Neuer, it was announced on Monday that UEFA had dropped the investigation because the armband represents, quote, a good cause. So UEFA made the decision to drop the threat of any sanctions against Neuer, which was especially relevant this week because it was the run-up to Germany's latest match, which is just about to happen at the time of recording, but will have already happened for all of you listening in the future. Any ideas who Germany are playing, Katie?
Could it be Hungary?
Oh yeah, good guess. As you might have also heard, in Hungary last week, Viktor Orban's government passed a new law banning the display and promotion, in inverted commas, of homosexuality to minors. This is yet another step in Orban's demonization of lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans and queer people whose life is being made more and more difficult thanks to Orban and Fidesz's actions. The government defends the law by saying that it's aimed at protecting children and stopping paedophilia, but rights groups in Hungary are not buying that and are really very worried about the possibly chilling effects of this new law.
There's also such a grim tradition of like drawing this link between homosexuality and paedophilia. Like you see it a lot in France, and I'm sure you see it lots of other places too.
Yeah, it's a textbook homophobic thing to do, and Orban has used it multiple times. It's not exactly clear what the implications of this law specifically are going to be yet, but it certainly has implications to how sex education can be taught. And one pretty bizarre effect of the law is that it could mean that even a film like Billy Elliot, a film that features a gay character, could be slapped with an 18 rating on it.
What? It's like the most family-friendly film ever.
I know. So that is why it's particularly pertinent that the German captain is wearing his rainbow armband whilst playing the Hungarian team, and that pride is being shown to be a mainstream thing to support as a footballer. And that brings me onto the other big pride footballing news from Germany this week that I am framing as good week for German efforts to support pride, but spoiler alert, this one doesn't end up quite as tidily as the first example. So the match against Hungary is taking place in Munich, and the huge stadium, which is usually home to Bayern Munich, is wrapped in this enormous wall of lights, which can be programmed to have lots of different colours. This gave some people the idea that the stadium should be lit up in a big, colourful wraparound rainbow flag for the Germany-Hungary match. A petition was signed, lots of signatures collected, and it was backed by the city council and the mayor of Munich. So the city took the idea really seriously, thinking it could be a great gesture of solidarity with LGBT plus people in Hungary. And they asked UEFA if they would allow this to happen. Guess what UEFA said?
Did they say no by any chance?
They said no. And they said that it broke their statutes about political or religious neutrality.
I mean, I suppose on one side you can see that it's kind of aimed at one specific national government, this message, right? Is it to do with that?
Yeah, that is what they specifically mention in their statement, that it's in response to a specific political decision taken by the Hungarian National Parliament. And I get it, it's tricky making decisions like this, but is supporting LGBT rights political?
I mean, like asking for all people to get treated equally doesn't seem like politics to me.
No, and if you take Ursula von der Leyen and the EU seriously, then the EU is officially an LGBTIQ freedom zone, and Hungary's law is endangering that. So you could argue that this pride flag would just be in line with some basic principles of Europe. There was a pretty heartbreaking statement released by a Hungarian rainbow family organization called Family is Family. They said to DW, a similar message coming from UEFA or from the players would have meant the world for many people. We are disappointed that the rights of LGBTQI people is too political. Banning programs and products that even mention LGBTQI topics is not political. It's the attempt to erase our community. And the mayor of Munich also had very strong words of criticism for UEFA, describing their decision as shameful. One thing that's really weird, in their statement they said, we actually think it's a really good idea. I'm not quoting them directly, but they're like, we think it's a nice idea if you light up the rainbow colours on the 28th of June or between 3rd and 9th of July. And I find it really weird that they like thought that it was their place to suggest other dates.
helpful.
But it does show this kind of awkward conflict between UEFA wanting to be an organization that's stopping discrimination against all types of people. And like, for example, UEFA had a boat at Amsterdam Pride 2 years ago. That wasn't controversial. It was nice. But I'd love to see if they could now decide to take part in Budapest Pride also. Otherwise, they're just deciding to support Pride when it seems to be more popular or less controversial in the country that it's in. And actually, it's more necessary in a country like Hungary than it is in here in the Netherlands. Mm. But hey, the fact that they suggested other dates suggests that they probably are having an internal struggle about this decision. And the nice news is that there are tons of buildings being lit up with rainbow flags across Germany during this match instead of the stadium. A number of Bundesliga clubs, Cologne and Frankfurt, for example, and also the city of Munich are lighting up the Olympic Tower and donning the town hall with rainbow flags.
Well, that's nice. We can retweet some of those pictures.
Yeah, we will do that. And I know I joked at the top of the show about how perhaps I was like surprised that I'm suddenly into football. But I realise that in part it is because as a gay man, I've always thought it's really not a sport for me. The culture around it has always seemed so macho, heterosexual and often quite homophobic. And perhaps one of the reasons why I am feeling like watching it again and enjoying it is because there are some signs of change, not just around homophobia, but also there are more female football pundits and presenters, and there seems to be more of an open discussion about the problems of racism as well. And I know there's still a huge way to go. There were reports of racist and homophobic chants and banners at Hungary's matches already, but I have really been noticing the progress that there has been since I last took any notice of football. And that's pleasing to see.
That is nice. I'm glad that you feel more welcome. I'd love to join you, but I can't.
Go back to your foraging. Who's had a bad week, Katie?
It's been a bad week for the Swedish Prime Minister, Stefan Löfven, because he is out of a job. He has just become the first ever Swedish Prime Minister to lose a vote of confidence, which is not a great accolade to have.
Whoa. Mm. So how did his government end up collapsing? Does it have anything to do with the kind of controversial COVID strategy?
Well, that is certainly the Swedish thing that grabbed the world's attention over the past year or so. The fact that they didn't really do lockdowns, unlike most countries in Europe. But no, that strategy actually ended up boosting Löfven's ratings. So it's got nothing to do with that. It's actually about a really interesting policy debate, if you'll excuse me nerding out for a minute. It's about rent controls. How much do you know about how housing works in Sweden?
Not much, other than the fact that loads of people live alone.
Yeah, that is quite an interesting feature of the situation in Sweden. The other thing is this long-standing policy, four decades of intervening quite heavily in the housing market. And the basic idea of these kinds of rent controls is to ensure that people have access to affordable housing, right? It is supposed to stop bastard landlords from charging people like extortionate amounts to live in the properties that they own, which seems like a good thing. However, a lot of people would argue that this system, in practice, has actually kind of been a disaster in some ways in Sweden. So it does mean that some people manage to have affordable rents in cities that would otherwise be really expensive. For a young couple in Stockholm, for example, sharing a one-bedroom flat, it would be about 500 euros a month from what I've read, maybe a bit more. Listeners in Stockholm, please feel free to write in if that's not quite right.
That sounds like really good value.
Yeah, it's good. But there is also often a crazy waiting list to get into this affordable housing. In some places, it's a 20-year wait.
Sounds like Amsterdam.
Mm. So if you're not lucky enough to have one of those flats, you often have to sublet on this huge black market. And the rents there can be like double what the rent control people have. And in some ways, you know, the system is supposed to help the worst off, but it's actually in some ways ended up making inequalities worse. Immigrants especially often find it very hard to get access to this rent controlled affordable housing.
Are you suggesting that a government actually fell because of housing policy? That sounds like so old-fashioned, and usually it's some like juicy scandal, but I think that's really cool if this is why it's happened. Maybe cool is the wrong word.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's weird. Most people would have thought that it would be like the handling of COVID or like some kind of, I don't want to say sexy topic, because housing is sexy, but you know what I mean.
It's really important, but I just feel like so often it's overlooked in politics.
It is indeed.
It does sound like the main problem with Swedish housing is that there's not enough housing. So like if they just built more housing, then the waiting list wouldn't be so long.
Yeah, so that is a very big part of the problem. There just isn't enough housing in some areas. And in some cities, the population has grown way faster than the amount of housing available. In Stockholm in particular, they have been frantically trying to build more housing in recent years, but it hasn't been quick enough to solve this problem. So enter this new government that arrived in 2019 with Stefan Löfven as prime minister. He comes in after the super chaotic election that didn't really have any clear winner. It's really hard to find a coalition of parties that looks feasible. Classic European story. And what happens after months and months of wrangling is that Stefan Löfven's party, the Social Democrats, they team up with the Greens to form a government. But even with the two of them, they still don't have a majority. So Löfven ends up signing a deal with two other centre-left parties, the Centre Party and the Liberals. And those two parties are kind of kingmakers. So they say, OK, we're not going to join your government, but we're not going to stand in your way in parliament. However, for us to do that, you have to agree to some policy stuff that we want. And one of the things that they demanded was this idea that for new built homes, there wouldn't be these rent controls. And the idea behind that is that one of the reasons why there's historically been a housing shortage, apart from this thing about people like living on their own for some reason, is loads of like one bedroom flats. The other thing is that there hasn't always been amazing incentives for property developers to build new housing, because if you can only charge quite low rent on them, that puts a cap on how much money you can make. So fans of this new idea have been like, okay, this is good. We will liberalize the system a little bit, and that will help us at least create more housing and also make the rents more flexible according to things like, you know, what areas are in demand and stuff like that.
But of course, I'm sure there are lots of people who think this is a really bad idea and that you should never get rid of rent control.
Right. So even though most people agree that the existing Swedish system isn't really working, there are lots of people who think that opening the system up to market rents isn't the solution. They think that what this is doing is just starting to chip away at this principle of insisting on affordable housing as a right. And they're also worried that it will mean more housing insecurity, because it would be easier to turf out existing tenants and replace them with people who can pay more. Some of the people who were really unhappy about this idea of relaxing the rent controls for new housing were the Left Party. So they are old allies of Löfven's Social Democrats. And they had also been helping to prop up the government in parliament, in addition to those two more centrist parties that had demanded this new housing policy. And the Left Party have now turned around and said, we are so deeply unhappy about this stance on housing that we are withdrawing our support. Now, they alone wouldn't have been able to topple the government. They only have 27 seats out of 349. But then some right-wing parties sensed an opportunity too. They kind of smell blood. And they were like, oh, okay, this vote of confidence seems like a goer. Let's bring this government down. So over the past week, we have had what has been branded an unholy alliance between the Left Party, who are very left-wing, and right-wingers, including the far-right Sweden Democrats, all teaming up to vote out the prime minister. It's been kind of surreal.
Wow. So what happens next?
So he has two choices, Löfven. He can either resign, in which case the Speaker of Parliament will try to find a new prime minister amongst the current MPs, or Löfven can call fresh elections. He has a week to decide what he wants to do, and at the time of recording, he hasn't decided yet. If he calls fresh elections, that will be quite annoying, because those elections are not allowed to replace the general elections that are already due next year. So there'd be like two elections in 2 years.
Oh.
And it'd just be super annoying, wow. Like loads of political deadlock and like faffing around.
So they've got a proper fixed term parliaments act then, unlike the one in the UK that didn't work.
Yeah, I mean, as usual in the UK, we don't really do things very seriously. Make it up as we go along. If the Swedes do the other thing where they just choose a new prime minister, Löfven could actually end up being chosen again himself, which is kind of crazy given that he just got kicked out. He is a veteran politician. He's seen as a very good negotiator. And there's not really anyone that obvious to replace him.
So maybe it's not been such a bad week for him after all.
I would say that it's been a very frustrating week for him. He has claimed that throwing Sweden into political turmoil is not very responsible of these other parties when Sweden is trying to climb out of a pandemic right now. It's a bit like when Renzi blew up the Italian government last year. And I do think that, you know, of course the Swedish Prime Minister is going to say he's not happy about losing his job. But it's true that the parties who've made this happen, they don't necessarily look great coming out of all this. It does feel quite opportunist of them. And a lot of housing experts, going back to that original issue, they're saying, you know, this housing issue is a ticking time bomb. We have to sort this out somehow. There has to be some kind of compromise. And actually, compromise is how we got here. The ironic thing is that Löfven himself is not wild about the idea of getting rid of rent controls. He's kind of an interesting character. He started out as a solid left winger. He was a welder in a factory and then a union leader. But over the years, he's made various compromises with other parties in an attempt to save the Social Democrats from sinking, even if sometimes that has meant moving the party more towards the right. And that is exactly how we ended up here. He signed up to an idea that he doesn't personally support because he felt that it was the compromise needed to be able to govern, and a compromise that was worth it. So that ability to survive and make deals, it's served him well in the past. So even though it's also the quality that has made him the first Swedish Prime Minister in history to get booted out in a vote of confidence, it could also be the quality that makes him bounce back again. Speaking of Sweden, we had a lovely new Patreon join us this week, who I think is our first person to sign up to support us in Swedish krona. But it reminded me that you can now sign up to support us in a bunch of different currencies. Euros, pounds, dollars of various descriptions, and Swedish krona.
So thank you very much to Lakesh Mano and also to Adele O'Flaherty for joining us on Patreon and donating a little monthly amount to keep this lovely little podcast going. It's a bit arrogant of me to call it a lovely little podcast, perhaps.
So arrogant.
If you'd like to join them, then head over to patreon.com/Europeans podcast. We really wouldn't be doing this without the financial contributions from our supporters. So if you have any spare cash, we'd be very grateful.
Lots of places, you may have noticed, are named after men. On this continent, to name but a few examples, did you know, Dominic, Bucharest?
Is that a man?
I think his name was Bukur originally. He was a shepherd.
Ooh.
Kiev, named after a prince.
No way.
On the other side of the pond, you've obviously got your Vancouver, you've got your Washington. I briefly thought that Alexandria in Egypt might have been named after a woman. But of course, it's named after Alexander the Great. We don't even get that one.
Ugh.
And it's not just cities, of course. If you look at street names and station names, in Paris, we really go in for naming metro stops after military generals in a big way. The point is, it is rather glaringly obvious that the people we name these public landmarks after, the way that we've done this traditionally, has been hopelessly unrepresentative. And this has more than a little to do with the fact that women have often found themselves erased from history and having to reach a higher bar than men just to get remembered. And yet, as we all know, there has been a really good effort in recent years to try to start correcting that imbalance. I recommended a book a few weeks ago, Toxic's Almanac, that is full of stories of women who deserve to be much, much better remembered by history. Another great initiative that has been making waves over the past few weeks is a lovely project spearheaded by the Irish journalist Mary Fitzgerald to reimagine the metro map of Brussels as if each of the stations was named after a European woman, someone who has shaped the history of this continent. There is a Joan of Arc stop, there's an Angela Merkel stop, there's an Anne Frank stop, lots of them you won't have heard of. And we're going to talk about why. With Mary, along with someone else who's been very involved in this project, the Italian writer Francesca Cavallo, best-selling co-author of Goodnight Stories for Rebel Girls, which is, of course, a celebration itself of extraordinary women who deserve to be much better remembered. And yeah, the three of us had a great chat, triangulated between Rome and London and Marseille, where Mary lives, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. Where did the idea come from to reimagine the map of Brussels, renaming all the stations in this way?
So the idea was inspired by a project by the American writer Rebecca Solnit in New York a number of years ago, where she and geographer Joshua Jelly Shapiro basically took the New York subway map and decided to rename all the stations after women who had contributed to New York's history and also contemporary New York. And in late 2019, I proposed the idea to Friends of Europe, the Brussels think tank, that we do a European version of this, where we take the Brussels metro map as a creative frame in which to tell a new story of Europe through renaming the stations, all 69 of them, on the Brussels metro map after women who have contributed to Europe, have helped shape the continent from ancient times to the present day. And I think what's important to state here is that this is not an EU project, it's about Europe as a continent. So we do have women from countries that are not EU member states. We have women, some of whom have their inclusion has raised eyebrows. Margaret Thatcher is one. So some people have asked us, why is Margaret Thatcher there when she was skeptical about the EU, as many people see it? But this is a broader story about Europe as a continent from ancient times to the present day.
Okay, so you have this great idea to make this map. How did you go about choosing the women who appear on this map, including Margaret Thatcher?
So we put out a call out for nominations, and then it was about whittling those nominations down to the 69 metro stations, which was quite interesting in terms of how we went about that. We decided we wanted at least one woman from each EU member state. And then after that, it was about compelling stories, stories that contributed a bigger story about the wealth of contributions that women have made to Europe.
Francesca, you are the co-author of hugely successful children's books which celebrate brilliant women throughout history. That must have been quite helpful when choosing these new metro stops. Were there any stories from your goodnight stories where you just thought, you know, this person has to go on the map?
When you start surrounding yourself with all of these stories of incredible women who shaped history, and in this case, who shaped Europe, you sort of understand how little we know this part of the history of Europe, of the history of the world in general. And even, you know, journalists and people who are who perceive themselves as being quite informed on the history of our continent were so surprised when they discovered so many stories that they had no idea about. This part is very revealing. For sure, one of the women that was included, since we talked about it, is Margaret Thatcher. And despite the fact that I absolutely have nothing in common with her politically, I believe that her inclusion is important because she's a character that I was harshly criticized about when I included her in Goodnight Stories for Rebel Girls. Because the point is that when it comes to women, it is so hard to be included in history books that we are required to be saints, literally saints. In Italy, for example, 97% of streets and squares are titled to men. Only 3% are for women. And of these 3%, 90% of these women are saints. You literally have to be a saint in order to have a street title to you. One thing that we're not realizing in liberal, you know, circles is that we are requiring women to be liberal saints in order to be included in history. And we don't require that of men. So why should Margaret Thatcher not be included in a project like this is the question that we need to ask. Because if we are asking that we are perfectly politically aligned with a woman in order to recognize her contribution, we are adopting a completely different standard than we are compared to men. And this is a problem that we liberals have to understand because this speaks volumes of our interiorized misogyny.
I consider myself to be someone who is interested in European history. I also think of myself as a feminist, but I have to confess a lot of the names on this list were new to me. Do you think that is because of this like tendency to under-celebrate the role of women, or is it because Europeans are bad at knowing each other's histories, or is it both to some extent?
I think is both, probably, but for sure, there is a huge part that plays into this of understating the contribution of women. This is at play every day. I mean, we see it. Yeah, I'm sure you see it in your daily life. Sometimes we're like, maybe I want too much recognition for what I am doing, or maybe this is just vanity. It's tricky, right? Because there is no way in your personal life to understand what is the right level of recognition. But the point is that when you sum up all of our individual stories, patterns emerge. And a project like Women of Europe helps exactly to do that and to help you realize as a European woman that your story, your daily experience is part of a broader experience. When you start to see clearly these patterns, that's where you can start taking action. And to see this pattern embodied in a city is something that politically is extremely powerful.
I also think as well that what's been interesting in terms of the reactions we've had to the map from various people across Europe, what's been striking is when you challenge people to see how many women they recognize in the map, people are surprised at how few people they recognize. And for me, this was very much a reminder that I think we as Europeans do not tell each other our stories often enough. I'm often struck by the fact that the story of Simone Veil, the French Holocaust survivor who became the first president of the directly elected European Parliament, is actually very little known outside Francophone Europe, despite the fact that her story, her personal story, is in so many ways the story of 20th century Europe. You know, her passion for the EU was driven out of her personal experience during the Second World War. So stories like that that haven't really emerged from so much from their national context. And I think that kind of continental-wide conversation is something that needs to happen more. What I found interesting about reactions to Thatcher's inclusion was that people were overlooking the fact that Thatcher was the first female prime minister in Europe. You may disagree with her politics, but you cannot take that first away from her. And many of the women on the map are firsts in their field. There's also the Prague-born Bertha von Suttner, who was the first woman to win a Nobel Peace Prize, for example. One of my personal favorites on the map is, and a story I was not aware until we did this project, was a story of Carolina Beatriz Angelo, who was a Portuguese woman who basically exploited an ambiguous electoral law to become the first woman in Portugal to vote in 1911. 2 years later, the electoral law was changed to ensure that that would not happen again. So I loved that story. And the map is full of stories like that, that I think are really powerful way of sharing our stories as Europeans and seeing what we can learn from each other as national contexts.
What's the response been like to the map? How have people reacted to it?
There's been a great response. You know, people have been intrigued by the map. People have been provoked by the map. What we envisaged this project as was an art piece, a conversation piece, and also an educational tool. A number of teachers have expressed interest in incorporating it into their teaching packages. It was interesting to see how, again, people didn't recognize a lot of names on the map. So some people were complaining that they didn't see their country recognized until it was pointed out that, you know, woman X or Y was actually from their country. So that was interesting in terms of, again, the lack of awareness of many of these stories and the need, therefore, to celebrate these stories more.
Do you think initiatives like this one will encourage cities and city planners to actually start thinking more representatively when it comes to naming new streets, new buildings, new metro stations?
Absolutely. I think initiatives like this are crucial because they start questioning the default mode, which is, as we are all aware of, titling a street to a man. If people don't start to question that notion with initiatives like this, we are never going to change it. Once you make that decision, it's something that stays there for at least 10, 20 years. So it is really, really important that the people, you know, the administrators, city administrators, start questioning the idea that notable men of a city are the default way to go.
We also see a number of initiatives already happening in European cities in terms of this, you know, this idea of starting a conversation about how much the names of men dominate public space, whether through public transport stations or the names of parks, streets, etc. The Brussels Public Transport Authority actually is taking some steps to ensure that women are recognized more within its system. So earlier this year, on International Women's Day, they temporarily renamed a number of stations after prominent women. And they have also promised to permanently rename a number of bus and tram stops over the next years. And there's a similar project to ours afoot in London, where basically it's an effort to reimagine London's tube map, renaming all the stops after women who've contributed to the city. So it is interesting that these ideas are gaining momentum and fueling more of a public conversation, I think, about how women are recognized and celebrated within public space across Europe.
As Mary said, this wonderful project is a collaboration with the Friends of Europe think tank. It is called Capital of Europe, Women of Europe, and you can find it at the link in the show notes. It's very, very cool. You can download a high-resolution version of the map. There are biographies of all the women named on this map, and it's a really fantastic resource if you are a teacher or a parent or a general human being. It's well worth your time. What have you been watching this week?
I started watching We Are Who We Are, which is this new actually, it's not new at all. It was came out at the end of last year. Classic me, a series from HBO by Luca Guadagnino, who made Call Me By Your Name, which I'm sure you did see.
Ah, yeah.
But yeah, it's not new, but I have just found a way of watching it legally in the Netherlands on Starzplay, if you're interested. And it's a coming-of-age story about two 14-year-olds who live with their parents on an American military base in Italy. And I've only watched the first episode so far, so I don't know where it's going to go. But mainly, I was just fascinated by this setting of the show. It's such a weird place, an American military base, because they have like American supermarkets, American schools, but it's actually all in Italy. And if you step outside of the base, you're surrounded by Italian people and Italian culture.
That is a fun setting.
It really is. I really recommend you check it out, especially if you enjoyed Call Me By Your Name.
Is it beautiful in the same way that Call Me By Your Name is beautiful?
Yes, it is really beautiful. Although I did find the main character in the first episode quite annoying. That's my one caveat.
Okay.
I'm sure I'll grow to love him. What have you enjoyed, Katie?
I have been watching the new episodes of Lupin, obviously, which have recently dropped on Netflix. And I am having a very good time watching France's favourite gentleman thief. It's just a silly and escapist and great as the first half of the series. The other thing I want to recommend this week was something that I stumbled upon on Arte, the European TV channel, which is such an untapped treasure trove.
So true.
They've got loads of like cool shows and documentaries. But I found myself this week diving into a little series of short 4-minute videos that they've done about urban design around Europe. It's called Ecotopia. And it is about like well-designed neighborhoods that do clever stuff with their water, or they're set up in a way that like favors social diversity. And I found them very relaxing for some reason. I do tend to waste a lot of time on YouTube anyway, like watching videos about architecture.
Really? I didn't know that about you.
Yeah.
How have we been making this podcast for all these years and I didn't know this weird fact about you?
There you go. You learn a new thing every day. But yeah, I think it's very nice to watch just a 4-minute video that reminds you that people are doing really clever things and not everything is terrible. They are a little bit cheesy, these videos, in that the voiceover is done by several people like personifying the towns. So it's like, well, town number one, I do this with renewable energies. What do you do?
Oh, no. I was really ready to like stop the podcast and go and watch these. And now you've said that, I'm not sure if I can.
It is a little bit kooky, but it's fun.
Also, before we go, I wanted to mention that the queer issue of our favourite European magazine, Are We Europe, is in the printing press at the moment and should be arriving on my doorstep soon, I hope.
Yay.
Apparently it's full of stories from all angles, contributors from all backgrounds, identities, and from all corners of Europe. So go and order your copy at areweeurope.eu or at your local magazine store. It's it's Pride Month, so it's a pretty Pride-heavy episode from me this week, because I'm going to leave you with the cheering news that this past weekend, thousands of people took to the streets and marched during the Warsaw Pride Parade, which is the largest Pride Parade in Central Europe. Things are pretty awful in Poland for a lot of LGBT plus people. And according to the Rainbow Europe rankings, it's currently the worst country for LGBT plus rights in the EU, worse than Hungary for the second year running. And yet, despite this struggle, thousands and thousands of people came out to celebrate the community and to celebrate tolerance. The mayor of Warsaw, Rafał Trzaskowski, said, "Here beats the heart of a smiling, open Poland." That cheered me up anyway. Apparently I'm like up for being cheered up by people's optimism this week.
It's most unlike you. We are going to two places next week. We are going to Eastern Romania and we're going to Berlin for part two of our amazing series, This Is What a Generation Sounds Like. We are very, very excited for you to hear it. It is just as intimate and beautiful as the first part of that series, which took us to Italy. Do not miss it. It will be out next Thursday.
If you're missing us before next Thursday, then check us out on social media. We are on Twitter at EuropeansPod, Instagram at EuropeansPodcast, Facebook, The Europeans Podcast. Or you can email us, hello@europeanspodcast.com. I made it sound like socials. We're actually on the socials, like it was a new thing.
Hey guys, did you know we're on all of the social medias?
We made ourselves a Twitter.
The show was produced this week by me and Priyanka Shankar. Our team also includes senior producer Katz Laszlo and producer Andrei Popovicu.
I wanted to send out a special thanks to all our team who have been working really hard recently on a lot of exciting things coming up. Thank you, everyone. From us.
Thanks, guys. And thank you also to our friends at Are We Europe. We are part of their podcasting family. You can find like-minded European podcasts at the link in the show notes.
See you next week.
À la prochaine.